I'd like to know how you got that.
It is Friday, May 5th, 2006, and it is 13 minutes after 3. And I would like to recognize the staff that we have today. Our House Recording Secretary is Kelly Burnett, and our LIO moderator is Chris Fannin, and my Hess aide is Linda Miller. And before we start, if anyone has their cell phones on, would you please turn them off? And let the record show that Representative Gatto, Representative Gardner, Representative Cisna, and myself, Wilson, are present today. And many of the rest of them are either on finance or in other committees because it's kind of crazy right now. So we're going to go ahead and start. Today our agenda is we have SCR 28, Technology for Distance Education, Senate Bill 251 and Senate Bill 48, and then hopefully we'll have some time to do a little bit of our work session after that gets going. After that goes, we're hoping things move fast today. So let's do SCR 28, and that's our Technology for Distance Education, and that's Senator Dyson's bill, and Wes Keller is going to present it. Is this your right here, or is this somebody else's?
It doesn't matter.
Okay. Just come on forward
I need that card.
And if that's, yeah, just we'll just ignore you guys. Okay, Wes, go ahead and explain to us exactly what your resolution does.
For the record, my name is Wes Keller for Senator Fred Dyson. Senator Dyson is chairing Senate Hess at the moment, otherwise he'd be here himself. And thank you very much for hearing this. I believe you all have packets with a PowerPoint display, and we're not, I'm going to explain why we're not going to go over it in detail other than the fact that everybody's worn down and tired, but it's all information. Most of it is information. It comes directly off the EED website. If you go in there and look at AYP in the report card to the public, that data comes from there. I made some of the graphs that are in your packet, but it's all from that information. Okay. The things that didn't come from there, one of them is the NAEP results, the National Assessment, National Assessment of Education Progress reports that was printed by the Department of Education. And it just basically shows that Alaska, we're 70% not proficient reading writing, same as the nation. It's about average. And but anyway, that information did not come from the EED website. And also, I had some points in there that just talk about technology, but there's no need to go over that. But if you would turn to page 5 or slide 5, that is titled AYP in Alaska Schools. Again, this is information from the EED website. I just wanted to point out that there's a trend where the numbers of schools that are getting to the level of restructuring is growing. If you extrapolate over this, what's happened over the last couple of years, next year there will be, could be 50 schools that are in what we call level 5 of needing improvement, and those levels are defined very carefully and well in the on the EED website, but I don't want to repeat what you already know, so we won't.
And what happens when they hit level 5?
Well, that's the train wreck. That's the problem, because when we get to that point, then the district has to make a plan and implement a plan that does a number of things. One of them could be reopen the school as a charter school after level 5, or replace all or most of the staff, or maybe contract with private management, or turn over the management to EED or some other major restructuring process, whatever EED comes up with. We have 7 schools now that are a second year of level 5, and so this is a crisis that is ahead of us. The point, I guess, is that this resolution doesn't offer the silver bullet and certainly doesn't offer any programs or anything to solve it. It's just one thing. It's a very positive thing, I think, that statement the legislature can make regarding the technology and a means to address it. technology basically makes the reduces the effect of distance. And I know you're all aware that Carl Rose from ASB has been passing around and talking about the book that the world is flat, and that demonstrates, you know, that distance is disappearing, or the effects of distance is disappearing on the, in the global market. Well, I have really gotten enthused personally on this because I have seen some demonstrations of education tools that are just phenomenal that do the same thing. And we have such a unique situation here in Alaska where we have remote rural schools beyond anything that anybody else even thinks about, that it's a perfect application for the for technology. So all this does, and I won't take any more time, all this resolution does is encourages the school districts to look for innovative, responsible ways to apply educational technology. And there's another interesting aside. Because Alaska is so unique, there's only 130-some thousand students. I happened to be in Washington, D.C. last week, and I was talking to the commissioner, they call him the chancellor there of New York. They have 140,000 employees for the school system. Here we have 130,000 students. So the point is that there are organizations national that are looking at Alaska to maybe make it a model for applying education technology. And that's really, you know, this could be really fun for us all, and it might really help us with grants and whatever. So that's why I'm motivated in this late hour of session to ask you to pass this and get it to the floor. SCR 28 is simply intended to raise the awareness and to encourage the momentum of responsible, innovative application of educational technology. A lot of school districts have done a lot already, and this is just, you know, to add fuel to the fire. And with that, the sponsor respectfully requests your vote and support of SCR 28. Thank you. I'll answer any questions too, of course.
Let the record show that Representative Corn has joined us.
Thank you.
And Representative Gatto, you have a question?
Yeah, page 2, line 4, that whereas says the highest median has the highest median cost for each student at $16,665. Just above it, it says federal, state, and local contributions average $10,000. If the contributions average $10,000 and the cost is $16,000, I'm wondering how to adjust those in my head.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that's a really good question, because I think it really demonstrates why this resolution is important. The median is the middle cost. So there's an equal number of above and below that cost, and the average actually is $10,500 and some, depends on where you look. But the difference, the delta between the average and the median, if you look at it, it's pretty easy to understand that it's a high cost of remote rural distance education, and so there's a delta in there that we have to work with. That some of that money can be reapplied to pay for some of this.
That's why we wanted the cost differential put in.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, what are the committee's wishes? Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I think that we have a lot of problems with our education system in the state, and the solutions will be wide-ranging. But clearly one of them, and principal among them, whether we're talking about boarding schools or smaller class sizes, it doesn't make any difference, all of them will relate to educational technology. And I'm prepared, Madam Chair, to move.
Could I make a comment first, just before you get there? I think it's pertinent. On page 4, you've listed all the places that are going to get copies. And I would have guessed it would have been all 53 school districts, but it doesn't look like it is. Was it intended to be? Because it looks like it stopped at the L's.
I think you probably were limited by the drafters of the bill, I would guess.
They required that, Representative Gatto, through the chair. They required the information on there, and I just provided it off the website and really haven't paid any attention, haven't gone through it item by item. But the key here is back up on page 3, if you go to the line 20 there, where it asks the superintendents to make sure this gets distributed to every school board member. So that pretty much covers it.
Conceptual amendment?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move conceptual amendment number one, that the list be continued to include all 53 school districts.
Hearing no objection, that has been adopted. Representative Gardner.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move concurrent resolution number 28, identified as 24-LS1849Y, with as amended, with attached zero fiscal notes.
Okay. Hearing no objection, this resolution has been adopted. Thank you very much. Thank you. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 251, Post-Secondary Student Meningitis Immunization. And this is behind tab 2 in your binder. And Senator Condi, or Condi.
Senator Bundy.
Condi Rice is here.
And his staff will present the bill. So go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Jane Alberts, and I'm staff to Senator Bundy. Senate Bill 51 is sponsored by the Labor and Commerce Committee and was sponsored by request of businesses across the state who inadvertently were affected by the passage of HB 185 last session. Some background on the bill is last year, the passage of HB 185 required post-secondary schools to distribute information to prospective students regarding the threat of meningitis. And that required that they retrieve confirming signatures verifying their receipt of this information. Originally, HB 185 was passed in order to have students be aware of the threat of meningitis when they were residing in dormitories, which studies have shown that that is a breeding ground for this for meningitis. And what happened with the passage of that bill is that all of a sudden, if you were going into a day school or some kind of seminar, these businesses are having to also collect the same type of data. It would be like if everybody who went to house finance today would all have to sign up and say whether or not they've had a meningitis shot because they've been in there for 4 hours and they go home at night. So anyway, it was an unintended consequence. So on behalf of those folks out there, and I think there's something like 136 schools now, I do have somebody online who can verify some of these technical questions, but there's quite a few people being affected out there, and they just want to get out from under that that paperwork requirement. So it would exempt these kind of schools from that tracking of information. So who I have here, I think online, is Scott Thorson, a businessman from Anchorage. He will tell you firsthand how HB 185 is affecting these businesses across the state. Jim Butler, I think, is online from Public of Health for questions, and then also Diane Behrens from Post-Secondary Education, and I think they're with me online.
Okay. And if I remember right, also on that is that the university, only if they are living in the dorms. Is that correct?
That was the intention of the bill, that you intended to reside.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Given that I think we all agree that the original bill, the intention was for residential facilities and not typing colleges or something like travel schools, and given that we are all sort of pressed for time here, do we need to hear all the testimony about it?
You know, I think that we do all agree on this, and let me ask the people that are online. What we're doing now is we're thinking about just passing this bill right on out, and our time is very precious to us this time of the year. And if it's okay with you, say nothing. If you still want to testify, speak up. Okay, then I will close public testimony. And do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate Bill number 251, described as 24-LS 1503-A with attached zero fiscal notes. And I think that's it.
Hearing no objection, we have now adopted Senate Bill 251. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the time.
All right. And we have another bill that's come up, Senate Bill 48. Let the record show that Representative Anderson has joined us. We have another bill. We have debated this bill already, and we held it over so that we could work on it and have everybody come up with a committee substitute. So, Senator Davis, would you like to present your substitute?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to present the bill, but I have a couple things to say. First of all, I want to thank the committee, the chair and the committee, for working with me over the past few days to try to come up with what they see us that would be acceptable by many of the stakeholders that's going to have some involvement with this bill. And I can truly say now that there's been contact with principals and administrators and a variety of people that had some input. They do have a copy of the proposed CS, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, in your package there. And so Richard is going to be the one that's going to go through the bill, and then you can take it from there.
Okay, and I think most of us have had a chance to review the bill.
I hope so.
And so Richard just kind of hit the highlights. Yep.
For the record, my name is Richard Benavides, staff to Senator Davis, sponsor of Senate Bill 48.
Well, you know what? Can I have a motion to put this committee substitute before us? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 48 version S to be adopted before the committee for discussion purposes.
X. That's X like xylophone.
X is in X-Men 3. Coming this way.
Xenophobe.
Thank you very much. And so now we have, as a working draft before us, version X.
For the record, I'm still Richard Benavides, Senator Davis. I'm not even sure where I am anymore. Strike that from the record. I tried to incorporate the proposed amendments that were given to me earlier, and the draft that you have in front of you, the major changes, if you will, are beginning on page 1, line 11, where we have expanded what we've tried to do on this prohibited items is we try to put in an exception for those times when a child was already on the medication, the school personnel already knew that they were on the medication, and for whatever reason, they have stopped taking the medication, or the medication has been changed around, and they feel that there might be a problem. This allows the school to be able to have a discussion, if you will, with the parents, because at this point in time, the child would either pose a risk of harm to themselves or others without the medication, or the medication is necessary for the mental health of the child themselves, and this is with the opinion of the child's treating physician. Going to page 2, if you notice on the previous version of the bill, there was an exception. There was a number 6 that was an exception as far as making a report of suspected child abuse or neglect to authorities. We were told over and over again that it was very confusing, so that language has essentially been moved and incorporated into page 3, line 1 through 4, which essentially states that nothing in this bill can be construed, or this section of the bill, can be construed to prevent teachers or other school personnel from complying with the requirements of reporting or filing a report to authorities if the child poses a serious and imminent risk to the child or other person's safety. That, again, was asked for by more than one school individual. The other portion, if you look on page 2, again, on the work draft, we've stricken the terms, which was on C in the original S version, psychiatric or behavioral health evaluation of a child that was struck. If you look at, I'm trying to do this as quick as I can, If you look at complying with federal law in the S version, which was the prior version, it stated that in compliance with federal law, it had to do complying with federal law. What we've done is changed that to say in compliance with federal education law or applicable state law, so that it can encompass the state laws and federal laws.
Now what page and what line is that?
Okay,
page
that three. Would be on. So
it's on page three.
Page on version X, page 3, lines 5 through 8. The version S was page 2, line 30 and 31. It would be page 3, line 1 and 2. Sole purpose of complying with federal education law has been expanded to include applicable state law. Violations on page of the original version that you saw here, page 3, lines 29 to 31, and continuing on page 4, lines 1 through 4. At one point in time, this was it constituted substantial noncompliance. We have modified that so that on the X version, it would be page 4, lines 3 through 5, basically stating each board shall adopt a policy that provides for disciplinary action, and I understand there's going to be modification of that language also to soften that just a little bit. Those are the major changes to the work draft that we have in front of us, the X as opposed to the S version. Now, I'm certain that I've confused a few people. So.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, I will direct this to you or through you to the sponsor and her staff. Who, post these amendments, who still opposes the legislation? Just so we have a bearing on where, because I had calls come in. You and I talked again in Liesl's office, and I was certainly supportive at that stage. And then there was a lot of discussion, debate, concerns rose. You have.
I think we have some things that if we just make little tweaks, everybody would be happy.
Okay.
So, you know, I think, you know, I've talked to him, and I don't. If it's nothing substantial at all. But I think we need to discuss it and think about it. But Representative Gardner, you had some.
I actually do. I have three questions. Are we through going through it?
Yeah.
Okay. My first question concerns page 1, line 12, about requiring a child to take drugs when in the opinion of the child's treating physician, the medication is necessary. And I guess, you know, if I were a parent and I decided that the medication wasn't helping or was injuring my child and wanted to discontinue it, I'd maybe go to another doctor, get another opinion. Which opinion would the school use? But before you answer that, I just want to tell you a little story. When I was a guardian ad litem, I had a child who was so severely abused and so much violence in her household. She was diagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder. She spent a year in a residential treatment facility, and every time she was about to see her dad, she would flip out, be very, very violent, and they would increase the amount of medication she was taking. Her father, meanwhile, spent this year in treatment, doing a case plan, working with therapists, working with the child therapist, but she wouldn't see him because she was afraid of him. And the school increased her dosage, and this was under a psychiatrist, of course, increased the dosage in the medication. Finally, it got to a point after a year when I, as a guardian ad litem, was very worried this child hadn't even seen her dad and refused to, and they asked again for permission for more medication. The father said, no, enough's enough, and I agreed with him, and OCS disagreed and sided with the school, and we went to court, got a court order, and the school said, if we can't drug her more, she can't stay here, and so she was sent to another facility with a different doctor who said, I agree, she shouldn't be medicated. And she was home in a month.
Oh, I'm sure that's a true case, and I'm sure there are many of those out there. But as far as this is concerned, the parents still have a right not to give their child the medication. The exception was made if the child was already on it and then the teacher would have the right to come back and check to see what it was going on. If it was deliberately being held, had they discussed it with the doctor, or if they should decide that they don't want the child on the medicine, they would not have to give the medicine to the child in order to get the child back into school.
Thank you. So if they had a second opinion that said no medication, I'd be okay. All right. I can live with that. Madam Chair, I have another question.
Okay. Follow up.
As a parent with kids in school, my child wants music lessons. I'll go ask a teacher, do you know anybody who gives violin lessons? If my child has a learning disability and I've talked with the school about the child struggling and I want help for the child, it's natural. I ask the teacher, can you recommend a program or a tutor to help with my child? So I'm uncomfortable about page 2, line 5, item 4, that teachers can't recommend a specific licensed physician, psychologist, or other health specialist. And I understand that there could be teachers who are used to having kids medicated who would steer parents toward that because they believe in it. And I do understand that concern. But at the same time, teachers are experts. They see the range of children's behaviors. They deal with hundreds of kids over the course of their careers. They have expertise. They have relevant experience. And it just seems to me that if a teacher is asked a direct question, they should be able to answer it to the best of their honest ability, as in, who do you think could help me if I'm a parent with a troubled child? And I'm very uncomfortable about not allowing a teacher to use their expertise and experience to answer direct question and setting them up where they can't answer.
Madam Chair?
Representative Sisler?
I have something to add to that very specific question, because in this specific instance, there's only one community that I know of in Alaska that really you could have a list of resources for most psychiatric concerns. There are Anchorage is the only place that has a number of psychologists, and there's different specialties. So even Anchorage has a limited number of certain specialties, but most communities in Alaska, you're lucky to have a psychologist. You're lucky to have someone that works with there. So I'm just wondering if there's a way to make the wording just a little more appropriate for the state.
I really don't know if there's wording that could make it more appropriate to please you, but I do want to say this about bills in general. When bills are passed, they do not always meet the requirements for every area. You know, you have to make them work for where you are based upon your regulations, your policies, or whatever you put into place. And as far as providing a list, you might, even with that list, you know, a one-on-one talking with the teacher and a parent, even with that list of names, they might say with that complete list that they have, I have used that particular one, but I'm not recommending that you use that one. I don't think teachers are qualified to do that. I really don't think they are, and I don't want that in the bill to give them the authority. And you said all teachers have that knowledge to know who to go to, that's not necessarily true.
But, Madam Chair?
They're not trained for that.
But I'm going to...
Are you finished? I didn't want to interrupt you.
I'll stop right there for now.
Well, okay. I'll wait until you're finished.
Go on.
Okay. Well, I just, to facilitate this, someone like Representative Gardner's expertise, social worker, I mean, you have a lot of degrees, you know your stuff in that realm. If she were to get a teacher certificate, and just the hypothetical she used for herself, and in 5 years she's been teaching, let's say, and someone, a parent comes up and says, hey, you have expertise, I know you're even a legislator, I mean, you've dealt with legislation, you've dealt with the medical aspect in the social work construct, what advice would you give? Would she have to immediately, based on the bill, cut off and say, I cannot discuss this, or my butt could be actually fired as a result? So I want to terminate any discussion. I mean, how extreme, that's the fear I think the folks are saying. How far are we going? Is that accurate?
Well,
I mean, in not so theatrical way?
I just am not comfortable. I understand teachers aren't psychiatrists. They're not, they can't recommend treatments or course of treatments. But it just seems to me that if we tie people's hands where they cannot use their best judgment when they have something to offer, and if I as a parent say to a teacher who's describing a problem my child has, and I say, you know, can you recommend somebody? I don't want to put teachers kind of back up against the wall where they don't know what they're allowed to do, allowed not to do. I just think that professional people should be allowed, knowing the limitations of their own experience and expertise, should still be allowed to give honest answers of what they do know. So, you know, if I'm a teacher, I could say, I've seen a, you know, another child who was treated by so-and-so had very good results. Is that against the law here, if this passes?
I wouldn't say that it was against the law or not against the law. What I have here is said to provide the list to them. You know, one-on-one, some things might happen, but we have, they do need to know that if they cross the line, that there's a possibility that they could be reported and some action might be taking place, even though you might have been doing the best thing that you thought was in the best interest of that parent. The parent could then go out and say to someone else, the teacher told me this is where I should take my child. And so you've opened that wide open. But that discussion is between you now, because I don't want it in here doesn't mean that it won't go in here. If you discuss it and put an amendment out there and it passes, if it goes in here, it goes in here. If I decide I don't want the bill to go any further than that because it's been watered down too far, then my prerogative would be to pull it. But it's your, in your hands now to decide what you want to do on that.
Representative,
you want to put forth an amendment, that's up to you.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Just conversation here without situations. Just because I have a wife of, I don't know, it's a lot of years now, so my anniversary is today, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So 35 years married to a nurse who is in the school system. And let me just describe what happens, if not every day, more than once a day, is a parent comes in and says, Kathy, can I talk to you? And they have this one-on-one, and they're always asking some sort of a question and asking for advice. If they're not doing that in the school, my phone rings at home. Is Kathy home? Just a minute. And I hear her conversing about someone who says, he's got 102 fever and he's got a cough. Anyway, she's giving out advice daily. That's, I think, her job, is to give advice as a school nurse more than it is to give medicines. Although, all day long, I see her chart. She gives medicines all day long. The issue, and well, let me just, if I can just read one thing, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I went to Google and I asked my staff just to download disorders that my wife needs to know about. And I'm going to read just a few of them. Acute stress disorder, adjustment disorder, agoraphobia, alcohol addiction, Alzheimer's, amnesic disorder, anorexia, antisocial personal disorder, anxiety disorder, Asperger syndrome, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and autism. Now, if you're paying attention, that's just the A's. There is a lot more letters to go. And I don't know that anybody can be familiar with all the potential disorders. So the advice pretty much is, if I were you, we have a problem with your, you know, your son is acting. What we do? We get that language, a person with a something disorder rather than something else. So we have a person with an anxiety disorder or so. You know what the mom's question is going to be. I guarantee it. It's, well, you're the nurse. What do I do? Oh, I'm sorry. I can tell you your child is having a difficulty, but I have a law, and by the way, we have $1 million worth of insurance to protect my wife that I buy every single year, because I'm expecting somebody to sue us over something she does or says. And in order to protect the family, we buy $1 million worth of insurance, because we're always getting in a school the mom and the dad who are not getting along. And if the mom does something that says, can you recommend this? And she says, well, let me see. You say something, and the dad finds out, then everything comes apart. Because the dad will most certainly go in there to say, did you recommend? I believe I have a law here that says you're not allowed to recommend.
And your wife might be better off with that law because, excuse me, Madam Chair, it's a good thing that you have that $1 million insurance because what I just heard you say is that your wife is given medical advice. She might be a nurse, but she's not the doctor. But there's nothing in here to stop someone if it's a friend of yours and you were wanted to give information one-on-one or something away from the school facilities or whatever. But in the context of this, it needs to say to not to be able to do that because she doesn't know all the conditions. So how is she going to address everything that comes to her? And the only medication that she's given it because it has been prescribed by someone. And the school, the parents is bringing it to the school because the medicine has to be given at the school. She didn't say, here, your child needs to be on this drug because they have this problem.
Well,
someone else decided that.
That's quite accurate.
Not the nurse.
She doesn't do that, but she gets asked questions that ask for, should I see a doctor? And she'll usually say things like, you know, before you do any kind of psychotropic medication, the doctor will probably say, let's do a complete physical to rule out some kind of electrochemical problem that's curable, a complete physical. Before
we, nothing in this bill that we're precluded from doing that.
Okay, you lost Gatto's vote, Peggy.
are you? I mean, I'm asking the committee if you think that I actually have a short list of four things actually that the schools would like to change. And what I'd like to do is go over that, and I'll get with you right real quick. What I'd like to do is go over that and see where how the committee feels about it, and then I think they're going to be content. They would rather not have the bill, but they would be content if we made these slight changes. But I know Representative Gardner, you had another thing you wanted to go, so you continue with your
Yeah, and this is actually the one that troubles me the most. And I know that, Senator Davis, you have a lot of knowledge about child abuse in this state and share the concern of every member of this committee about the volume of child abuse. And we have laws that certain people, I call mandated reporters, have to report. And the law says they don't make a judgment about whether it's well-founded or not. If they have a concern that a child is being mistreated in any way, shape, or form, they make the report of harm. I believe this bill calls it report of suspected child abuse or neglect, but with OCS, it's called a report of harm. And somebody else investigates it and makes a determination on it. My concern about Section 6 on page 2, line 10, is that it puts a sidebar on the mandate to make a report of harm. And a teacher has to say, gosh, I think this isn't good for this kid. Should I report this? Oh, I'm not allowed to. And I know that what we want to get at is that refusal to give consent to administering a prescribed medication is not in and of itself child abuse. And it's not subject to removal or China proceedings or anything like that. And it's not. I mean, the grounds for following up on a report of harm are very well described, and we adjust them periodically. But a teacher is a mandated reporter, and I don't think teachers should make the judgment. If they have a concern, make the report and let somebody else at OCS who is trained to evaluate make the judgment call about whether it's right or not. And I just don't want, we talked a little bit later in the bill about, and it's not specifically relating to here, but talking about disciplining teachers. And I just want to be really clear across this state that mandated reporters are mandated to make the report if they have cause for concern.
and I've been a school nurse, and so I've been in that position many, many, many times. Uh-huh. I was a school nurse 9.5 years, and so, you know, if you even think it a little bit, you're required to turn it in, and then they do a very, very detailed investigation, you know, depending on what they decide. You know, they look at it, find out the details, and decide whether it's legitimate or not, you know. And those are federal laws and state laws that we cannot change at all. So are you asking,
Madam Chair, I would like to offer an amendment, actually, to page 2. Simply delete lines 10 through 15. And that simply, you know, addresses the responsibility for report of harm and retains that teachers are mandated reporters without second-guessing themselves.
Okay. Hearing no objection, that amendment passes. Is there anything else?
Madam Chair, I would just like to add, and this is for Senator Davis.
So that was amendment number 2, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Amendment number 2, okay. And did you get that? Good. Okay.
By Berta Gardner, Midtown.
and just for the record, I mean.
It's on a roll.
What is amendment number 1?
That's right.
It is one.
I had one here, and then I'm thinking,
it's one.
Did I?
Oh, I thought you had.
No, that was to a previous bill.
Oh, that was the other one. Okay, yeah. Right. Okay. This is number 1. Yeah, sorry. I'm getting mixed up with the other bill.
For clarification, could I go back?
It's right here.
We did talk with social services, and in the end, they said that the language that we had, but we might have changed something. But are you saying that you want to take out line 6?
No.
Just line 6?
No, line 10.
I mean line 10, just number 6?
Yes.
Not the subsection?
Not subsection B, just number 6.
And right.
Well.
So that would be lines 10 through 15.
Yeah. Right. So teachers are still mandated reporters without any limitations on that.
So you don't want the reporting to be listed on it at all because they were supposed to know that?
They know that.
You want it to be silent?
It's already a law.
It's already a law. It's a
It is a law, but obviously you don't want it to be in the bill.
No. That kind of, when it's confusing. Yeah, it makes it really confusing. So, Representative.
Okay. As I understand it, the way that the bill addresses a teacher's obligation to report suspected harm is simply that a teacher is not allowed to do it based on a parent or guardian refusing to give signed consent. And I'm simply saying that there's nothing in our China statutes that says in and of itself.
But where do you see that in this bill? I don't see that. I don't know what you're referring to when you said it's in the bill. They have to have a signed consent.
It's on
It's right there, 112.
See, on page 1, line 7, it says they may not.
I see that.
And then that they may not unless, and 6 says, unless they make a report suspected of child abuse or neglect to authorities.
Based on the fact.
Right.
Because I think we could make it if that's what the problem is.
But they have to.
Mm-hmm. I know that. They have to make the report. At least they should.
But this says that under those circumstances, they can't.
If I may make a comment, this is Richard Benavides again. The intent in that section is not to prohibit teachers from making any report that they have to make. The intent is to make certain that that report is not based solely on A or B. Now, we attempted to cover that ability to report on version X, page 3, lines 1 through 4.
But it's kind of hard in a bill when one part of the bill says you can do something and the other part of the bill says you can't.
That's why I was saying maybe it's removing, but maybe it has to be the whole area removed out of there.
It's gone.
But if you remove it all, it doesn't,
well, this,
it doesn't say anything about reporting at all.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that if I, please correct me if I'm wrong, Senator Davis, but I think what you want to say is that it's not child abuse. It doesn't fall under our China statutes for a parent to refuse to give signed consent for the administration or treatment of a child, that that is not in and of itself child abuse, and that currently is the case. It isn't child abuse in and of itself under our China statutes. And my concern and the reason that I offered the amendment that passed is simply I don't want to inhibit a teacher's making a decision about whether or not to file a report of harm. It's not for the teacher to determine whether they're in compliance with China statutes. It's enough for them to know they're mandated reporters and they have a concern, and they don't have to worry about repercussions or discipline or anything else.
Okay, now let's go on to the next step. Was there anything else that you had, Representative Gardner?
That's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Now, I would like to go over the items that I had a request on, and that was on page 3 to delete, page 3, line 2, after of, insert subsection 1 of, because this defines that leaves the whole statute there open, and we want to get down to what you're really talking about.
Madam Chair, how about I make that amendment as you described, a conceptual amendment number 3.
This is amendment number 2.
Okay, so amendment number 2, Representative Gatto, do you mind objecting so we can discuss it?
I'll object.
Okay, and now you can, Madam Chair, could you describe what I just offered?
Okay.
Okay. Tell me where it is again.
Okay, so it is on page three, line 2, uh-huh. And after the word of,
okay, AS.
Insert subsection 1 of.
Okay.
And then after AS 4717020, insert comma. And after or, insert subsection 2.
I didn't know it was that long, or I would have.
So it's all right there in that, but it's just, so then it will read, that line will read, school personnel from complying with the requirements of subsection 1 of AS 4717020, comma, or subsection 2 from.
That's Madam what that Chair, line then I'll, that, that, that'll be my amendment to amendment 2, so we've added those other three changes.
Right.
So that's my amended amendment number 2. Okay. If there's no objection, then I would offer that.
Now,
and Representative Gatto objected for discussion.
Okay.
I still don't know what's going on.
No, I think that's a good change. I don't have a problem with
okay.
that.
So do you remove your objection, Representative Gatto?
You did.
Yeah.
Yes, you removed it?
I'll remove it.
Okay. The objection is removed, and so the amendment is adopted. And then there's one other one on page 4. On page 4, lines 4 and 5, delete lines 4 and 5 and add an employee violating AS 1430-171-1430-176 may be subject to disciplinary action. And then that will read, violations, each school board shall adopt a policy that an employee violating AS 1431-1430-176 may be subject to disciplinary action.
Okay, Madam Chair.
We were going to add that part to it, so that's good.
Okay, all right.
So, Madam Chair, then I would move Amendment 3 per the Chair's recommendation repeating what you just said conceptually.
Okay. And that is hearing no objection, so adopted. Now, that was Amendment 3. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Paul, you can do the next one.
Let's see.
First page. You haven't done anything on the first page.
No.
Didn't do anything on the second page. You took out this.
Yeah, I think first we took
did
this
we?
Out of page 2.
Now, still did we? I think we eliminated that. Did we eliminate 13 and 14 on page 3?
Verda, on page 3, did we eliminate lines 13 and 14 on page 3? In one of the three amendments already passed?
No, no.
She's talking about the other bill.
No. Amendment 1 was eliminating on page 2, line 10 through 15. Amendment 2 was the subsections 1 and subsection 2 on the top.
So, Madam Chair, no, to answer your question, that those have not been eliminated.
Amendment 3 was the employee.
Okay. Are you talking about version S?
X.
X. Page 2.
No, page three.
Page 3, lines 2.
Lines 13 and 14.
Yes.
And that's the last change that has been requested.
And that would be Amendment 4?
Well, just we need to, yeah.
You don't want them to be able to do that?
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton? I move amendment number 4.
And
it's been objected, so we can discuss that. It says, notwithstanding a behavioral mental health professional working within a public school system may, in compliance with federal education law or applicable state law, conduct a psychiatric or behavioral evaluation of a child with the consent of the child's parents. And that already, I mean, they can't do that already without, the only reason that would be pulled out is because they can do it already, it's in federal law, and when we repeat things, then people wonder what we're trying to say. And so all we're doing is just taking that out because that's already in federal law. They can't do that at all without a parent's consent.
And Madam Chair, the corollary is with parents' consent, they can do it with the appropriate professionals?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, and with that explanation, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. All right. Then the objection is removed, and so that amendment is adopted. Is there anything else? How does everyone else feel about this? I know we've really worked on this, but we've tried to work on it and not change the intent of the bill.
How about we change the number to Senate Bill 49?
Bring it up.
It might interfere with some other bill.
You know, it might have been A and B. It might have been A and B. Okay. And I want to go back to amendment number 2.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I would move that we rescind our action and adopt amendment number 2.
Okay. Thank you. And see, no objection.
All that work I did on that?
One part of that amendment where we had the...
Madam Chair, we lost where you were. Where are you now?
You know what? I'm not sure that's right. I think that was.
You want to see the statute?
Insert. I guess that's the two. Are you looking at that, Verda?
Yeah.
4717020.
Yeah.
Are we? We want to make sure we get this right. And
comply with the requirements.
Briefity.
Yeah, brief it is.
Madam Chair, I'd offer amendment number 4 that would
We could say number two.
If you rescinded number two, you probably shouldn't. Yeah, you know.
We could do new number two. New number two.
Trust her.
New amendment number two on page three, deleting lines 13 and 14, and on page three, line two, after the word of, insert subsection A and B of. That's the amendment.
Okay. Hearing no objection, new amendment number two has passed. Okay, Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I would like to offer a conceptual amendment, that being amendment number four.
Pardon? I'm sorry.
Four.
Number four, and it would
be number
five.
Five. And that would be to
what, where?
Page, I'm telling you.
You could also move it, rescind it, and it could be new number five.
Let's have a couple other comments before I offer
this stuff.
Okay, page three, and on line 29, and the line as it stands right now says, notwithstanding, and gives the AS
29?
Number. A school district may make available to an interested parent or guardian a list of community resources, comma, including mental health services. The amendment is, comma, after services, psychiatric specialists, including mental health services, and psychiatric specialists, and maybe another comma. Let people.
You use one, you better use the other one.
If the list conspicuously states the following, and then.
But doesn't mental health? I object. Discussion first. And my question is, doesn't mental health services include all of that?
What it does not do is give any kind of specifics. And parents who are looking for services want specific. They will be asking for someone who knows about a certain specialty, and this gives that that license to the schools. This language is saying you got to do this, or you're going to be sanctioned if you don't give this list. And there's provisions at the end. The specialist gives the ability for the school to actually answer the question the parent's asking.
However, if we add two things, there could be 18. And if we start putting it down, then we're going to limit.
It says mental health services and.
I think we need Max Groenberg's help.
I don't think so.
Representative Gardner.
Cotto.
We're used to it.
And I think Representative Sisna has a point in that mental health services seems to refer to organizations. And she is wanting to add N specialists, which then refers to individuals.
Well,
so as not to say you can do one but not the other.
Richard.
This, for the record, this is Rich Benavides again. If you read the rest of the, where it says conspicuously states the following, this list is provided as a resource to you. The school neither recommends nor requires that you use this list or any of the services provided by individuals or entities on the list. And since it's a may provide, the school district is free to place any services, individuals, entities, whatever you want to call them, on this list. So this is kind of an all-encompassing thing anyway. It would not specifically deny anybody being put on the list or any kind of entities being put on the list, and at the same time, it doesn't specifically require anybody to be put on the list. So it's the choice of that district, as you stated earlier through the chair, Representative Sisna, in a particular place, there might be one person on the list. Or an itinerant person on the list because it's a smaller place, whereas in a larger urban area, there might be 30 things on it. So we are giving the leeway of what that list is going to have on it and who's going to be on it to the school district.
Okay. And I think I'll keep my objection. Do you want to continue, Representative Sisna? Okay, then let's call the roll, unless there's more discussion.
I'd like to just comment and say that, in my mind, the language that's there is inclusive of psychiatric services, family services, or whatever. It's mental health services. So I don't see any need to specifically start listing what they may be.
But if you feel strong about it, we'll call the roll.
What is the sense of
the pre-roll?
I'll support you, but I don't think you have the vote.
You don't think so?
well, no, that's fine.
I just call the roll.
Just takes one more.
Who cares?
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
Off the record.
Representative Curry?
No.
Representative Stephen?
No.
Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Sisna?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Chair Wilson?
Well, no. She objected.
We have three yeas and four nays.
Okay, the amendment has failed.
You want a motion, Madam Chair?
I think we're ready for a motion.
It's time for you to fly. Okay, I move Senate Bill 48 with attached individual recommendations and attached, I guess, what? There isn't a fiscal note.
There's an updated fiscal notes.
Updated, is there a fiscal note? Okay, and then with, or as
there's
amended.
There's two fiscal notes and some updated
That's
ones.
That's what I was getting at. Okay, as amended.
All right, hearing no objection, the bill has been adopted. Congratulations.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And we're done with the bills, and now we're going to break and have a work session.
Can we cover 488 while we're here?
Which one's 488?
488, the PPT.
We don't need you. Okay. And
that's what
amendment number. Which one?
Yeah.
Amendment number four was incorporated into amendment number two. Yeah. So we can eliminate amendment number four.
That's right.
And this is.
Yes, there were.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we're going to.
We had it in mind, we'd be glad to.
Yeah.
Right.
be back on, and thank you very much for your help today. And what we're...
What? Well, there is that. There is that.
You've ever heard of herding cats?
Anyway, sorry. Yeah.
Okay. Chair, do you want to move over here with us, too?
Sure.
I'm sorry, Peggy. I'll be right back.
Okay. What we're going to... What my intentions are, what I'd like to do is have several work sessions between now and the end of special session. Because we can only absorb so much every day during special session. And so I'm hoping that we can meet in here and continue this. Maybe every other day or
And something. Remind me what we're continuing.
We are looking at any way we can contain health costs. And specifically within the HESS budget. The HESS and social, you know, health and social services budget. And so what we need to do is look at as many different ways as we can so that we can come up with recommendations. And so we're going to hear, I'm going to have Mike Hawker come and speak to us one time because he's in charge of that budget. He might have some ideas. And I've got Dwayne Peoples to come from the department today to kind of help us look at different things that might be we might be able to do that will make a difference. That
and
we
when
can
would
put
we
into place.
Do those?
Well, we will draw up either probably a recommendation from the HESS committee to so that at the start of next session we can implement them. We can make suggestions of things that can be done.
Okay.
So, Dwayne, if you could come forward and we will hopefully, Berta will be right back. So we'll take a brief at ease. Oh, here she is. We won't have to take a brief at ease. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
David, I'm at Hollister. Won his lawsuit.
Oh, way to go, Dwayne.
Yeah, they'll appeal it, I'm sure. But
okay. Okay. I'm. Cool. We've kind of mentioned that what we're planning to do here, and I've asked Dwayne to come from the department and see if the department has any suggestions or any areas, and I want us to take notes because we are going to hopefully find out and have some final recommendations so that when session starts next year, the HESS committee has made recommendations of things we can do. And I'm trying to not cut services, but see if we can cut money. You know, and I don't know if we can even do that, but I think that's the I think we have an obligation to start there.
I'm a little bit puzzled.
Can we do? Is this informal?
Yes, very, okay. Very informal.
When you say the HESS committee make recommendations, I mean, the way we make recommendations is by proposing legislation.
Well, and we might, the HESS committee might come up with legislation by the beginning of the next session.
You know, the other little problem I'm having right this second is that I'm thinking that we've been trying to keep up with this legislation and we've got floor sessions, and I have not done the kind of work on the PPP that I need to do. This is, right now, we're trying to do a good job on all of this. I've tried to stay focused on this, but now we're coming close to the yeah. end, and the PPT is looming as a really huge yeah, right. thing.
Can we, I tell you what.
Why not an interim effort?
Well, because everybody's got elections and things like that. And so it'd be very difficult.
Well, even in the special session something, but not at the
How about listening to what Dwayne has to say,
sure.
and then we'll adjourn. And then we can take those notes, because
sure.
he has waited all through this meeting okay. to get to this point. And we
and
believe
he was
appreciate
enjoying
it.
Every second of I could see that.
Okay,
are we record?
Sorry.
Are we on the record?
Yes, now okay. we're on the record, okay. and you go ahead. And
Dwayne Peoples, Division of Healthcare Services, Department of Health and Social Services. Having listened to your brief interlude and conversation here, I kind of came prepared just to talk about some general cost containment activities that the department's been working on. I really didn't bring anything to recommend for legislative action, so I don't know where you want me to go, Madam Chair. I can just go ahead and talk about some of the generic things that we do with cost containment.
Okay, well, that might help us think of other things, so we'd like to hear what you have to say.
Okay, Madam Chair, I've been in and around healthcare for almost 30 years, and the concept of cost containment has been in the forefront for those 30 years. And I don't know, my personal bias is cost containment is often where you find it. And you look at a system and you tweak it, and usually you focus in on a cost center or something that's sort of shifting out of the norm or an issue that's presenting itself, and you will do some adjustments, but usually those adjustments last for 1, 2, maybe 3 years, and then inflation and growth usually overwhelms these little adjustments you make. As you are well aware of, we did a preferred drug list 2 years ago, which was a very successful model, and I think we're saving somewhere between $7 and $8 million a year, and that has bought us a few years, but then the inflation and the growth will eventually overwhelm.
How much did it save us about?
It's kind of hard to tell, but I think between the we did a combined supplemental benefit program with other states. We went out and bid with 7 other states our drugs on a list, and pharmacies bid to us saying, we will give you this much rebate if you put it on your PDL, on your supplemental. Between that and recommending therapeutic equivalence in drugs and getting the cheaper drugs, like generic drugs, we probably save $7-8 million a year. And these are the type of things that, you know, the department is constantly looking for. We do a lot of utilization review, what's going on in the Medicaid program, looking at variations off the norm in utilization, whether it be pharmaceuticals or emergency room visits or physician visits, and focus in several areas. One is we look at the recipients' health-seeking behavior, what they're doing, and if we think that they're abusing the system, then we put them into a case management. If we think that the physicians are not quite up to practicing up to their best benefit or their best ability, we have a behavioral pharmacy program where we advise physicians based on their utilization patterns that you probably don't need 10 drugs, you may want to use these 3 drugs. The things that we're probably going to do in the pharmacy area is we're going to go back in and maybe adjust some of the, when you fill a prescription, we're going to go back and look at the dispensing fee, maybe reduce those to some little bit cost containment efforts, looking at maybe reducing our average wholesale price with other states and drugs. There's a whole litany of things that the department is constantly doing. This most recent legislation that you worked with, HB 426, with Representative Coghill, was some ideas we brought forward coming out of reviewing the utilization and what was going on, and we identified people not applying for Medicare when they needed to, especially in end-stage renal dialysis. There's a whole series of things we can constantly be looking at limits on how many drugs people should be getting before we start doing very heavy review.
You know, Duane, because we talked about that maybe 1 or 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how of the patients, and I personally think that if they take 6 drugs, we should be looking at it. But I can't remember. Did you say 10?
Well, I just used that as an example.
But we talked about that. How many of the people that are taking that many drugs have you actually gone into and reviewed?
Madam Chairman, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. We gave you a report a couple of years ago. I could go back in and pull some of the more recent utilization reviews.
It would be nice to know that, because that should be kicked out every single time, and because what happens, and I've seen it in nursing homes especially, is that the nurses will call the doctor and say, you know, I'm concerned because she's not eating anymore. She just kind of sits there and she's not interested. And the doctor will say, oh, well, then we need an appetite, something to spur her appetite. And sometimes it's just because she's getting too much of one drug. And lots of times the reason that they're having this problem is because all these drugs are starting, there's so many that they're starting to interact. And I know my father-in-law, my mother-in-law and father-in-law used to live with us in the wintertime, and he would stumble a lot and just about fall and fell every once in a while. And so I looked at how many medications he was taking, and it was, I think there probably was 10. And so I said, we're going to go to the doctor, and we're going to see if you can get off some of those. And they took him off all of them except three. He was fantastic. He wasn't falling anymore. It was wonderful. But they just built up one at a time.
That's scary.
Yes, it is scary. And so I think we could save a lot of money if we really zeroed in on those type of things.
It's called polypharmacy, isn't that right? Is that the term?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, yes.
What's it called?
Polypharmacy.
Polypharmacy.
Mm-hmm. It's the numbers of, it's the problem of having too many drugs. And it is a huge problem, I think, everywhere.
Especially if they go to more than one doctor.
Yeah, they go to a rheumatologist and a cardiologist.
Yes.
But one of the concerns about trying to track it is if somebody has a record of all the prescriptions that have been filled for a person, that doesn't tell you what they're actually taking. They may say, try this. Well, then let's do this instead. And the record doesn't reflect that they've discontinued.
Well, but they can tell how many they're paying for.
Right, so you buy a month's supply,
yeah,
and you try it for 2 weeks, and then you get a month's supply of something else.
Yeah,
so
that's true. I mean, it's not easy, but I mean, I would imagine it would save us a lot of money.
It'd be tough to do.
Yes.
I'm trying to figure out how you would do it, because it'd be...
Through the chair to Representative Sisna.
This is very informal.
Okay, we use... within the Medicaid Management Information System, we have a subsystem which does the pharmacy alone. And when a pharmacist enters into it, it is within seconds. It's logged in, and the pharmacist knows the feedback right away that they're going to get paid or whether this is a recipient or not. The whole thing is a very quick response. And in there, we know what's the prescribing doctor, the recipient, the pharmacist, the script, the milligrams of the script, the number, and the frequency. So we constantly do an analysis of this information, and we have a committee, it's called a Drug Utilization Committee, that meets about once a month right after we have our Pharmacy and Therapeutic Committee, and they go through this analytical material. And it's doctors and pharmacists and nurse practitioners and dentists. We also have another side project sponsored by a company where we are looking at only the behavioral health drugs. And we have a professional firm that this is all they do. They're helping us, and they do the analysis for the behavioral health drugs. And the physicians have peer counselors, experts, physicians in their field, and they coach and help and work with the prescribing doc to try to get the meds balanced and say, this is what's current practice right now, and why don't you move it this way?
Yeah, Madam Chair,
you know what? Just say, Sharon,
okay,
before you start talking,
okay,
so that she
Sharon.
Can, you
okay,
know, he
Sharon.
Doesn't have to, because she can tell it's a male voice, and he's the only male here. But
I do, I do know a physician's assistant at Neighborhood Health that is a neighbor, so I, you know, have talked about all of this with her and what she does, and that's one of the things that she does there. So I know that there are people, probably in various parts of the state, that are working on mm-hmm. trying to get, and her population is the homeless. So she's working with homeless. Now, if you could imagine what a tangled web that one would be. But it does make a significant difference in people's behavior and health outcomes, probably, and the whole thing to do that. But can that be expanded, or is it already being... Are you doing as much as you can do, or?
You could, Madam Chair, we could probably always do a little bit more than what we're doing. We identify the people that are doing fairly heavy utilization that borders on maybe abuse, and we put them into a case management structure. But then there's this long, drawn-out appeal process to, with the recipient rights. But we slowly get people in to modify their behavior, try to reduce the drug utilization, emergency room utilization, doctor shopping, where they go from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor. So we try to get that into a case management. And the way you do that is you get one physician who says, I'm the primary physician. It'll all be routed through me. You get one pharmacy that says, I'll be the single pharmacy.
What could you? I'm sorry, I kind of butted in. You had a question. You go ahead and ask your question first.
Okay, thank you. David Guttenberg's been doing a lot of work on pharmaceutical costs, and I, you know, from what he says, it's the fastest growing sector of medical costs, and I guess he probably isn't including things like PCA programs and such, but the actual direct costs. And he had a bill to set up a prescription drug task force within the Department of Health and Social Services. Are you familiar with that bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, Representative Guttenberg introduced a series of bills, and I kind of read all of them. I am familiar with them, but I've lost all the details. He had his most recent one that came through, I believe was heard before this committee, on pooling and purchasing in the task force in that manner.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
Okay, yes, I'm familiar with that.
Task force that would be set up within the department.
Now, how would that be different from what we're doing?
Madam Chair, the pooling that we are doing with the Medicaid program, is supervised under the federal CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They gave the state of Alaska and its partner states in this pool a plan amendment and authority to go ahead and pool for these purchasing of the drugs. They only allowed the states to do these pools for Medicaid drugs. So if you were to come back, and we're doing a fairly good job of it. I mean, our state has done a reasonably good job of controlling pharmaceutical costs. Representative Guttenberg's proposal, I think, is more global in looking at trying to round up all the consumers in the state, at least the big benefit plans like state employees and Blue Crosses and et cetera. Mm-hmm. Under the current rules of engagement with CMS, we could not bring into that pool the Medicaid.
But we could do a separate one.
You could probably do a separate one. I think other states have gone down that track, I believe, or have experimented with those areas. And other states have set up something, a separate commissions, something like you would have with the Railroad Commission, the Aerospace Commission, separate entities that are just out there, quasi-governmental agencies. And they do a lot of trying to pool health insurance. I believe Washington State set one up. They do a lot of trying to do the governing of health care procurement and benefit packages adjacent to government, but not tied solely to the rules of government. They don't have the procurement problems. They don't have personnel issues.
I have a question, because I know in my area you wouldn't have this problem. Well, you might have a problem in Anchorage, but in my area, there's just only one pharmacy, like, for instance, in Wrangell. There's only one pharmacy, and what the dispensing fee, if you lower the dispensing fee, I mean, is there any way that for the out areas where there's only one pharmacy that you wouldn't lower it, because they can't even get their medicine for what you guys reimburse them, their cost of their medicine, because they can't buy it in big bulk, you know, because there's only 10 people in town that use this medicine and 3 that use this one. So when you cut those things, it just kills them, because it costs them more than what they even get in burst, so they don't make any profit, you know. So is there a way to fix that?
Madam Chair, when you do adjustments to dispensing fees, you go out and do a big longitudinal study, and you weight them by the number of scripts they're writing, the number of total scripts, the prescriptions, and by how many you're writing for Medicaid. And some of them you raise up, some of them you raise down. Right now, our fee structure on the dispensing fee is weighted solely along how many of your, as a percentage point of all the scripts you write for Medicare versus your total. And so we have a very wide ranging. So when I was talking about reviewing that, we would study it first and then go through a hearing process, public hearing process, before we'd go ahead and implement anything.
Okay. It'd be just like a regulation review?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We would put it into that. One of the other things that we're just now starting to drift towards, the Division of Public Health, the Division of Healthcare Services, is chronic disease management. I know that is Representative Cisna's area of concern. And we're starting to look at that. Other states are doing it. There's several models on it. We are collaborating with the Division of Public Health, who now has a unit, a section for chronic disease management. And some of the areas we're starting to look at that's going to be a big growth in Medicaid expenditures is associated with diabetes. We see that just blowing out very big in the immediate future. And so as part of these utilization reviews, public health epidemiology people are looking into that, and we're trying to figure out a way, looking at other models in other states, to get case management, emphasize, maybe even reimburse physicians to target the preventive end of diabetes and where that's going to go, because it will become a greater drain on the Medicaid.
I think maybe that we're going to have to just really zero in on obesity, because that's the culprit, really, in most of it. If people can lose the weight, their diabetes goes away lots of times. And so I think that that we really... I think that what we can do, though, as a committee, is really zero in and maybe get some bills going next year on obesity, and see what we can do for the state, because I think that's... And I did talk to Carlene Jackson, and she said that she would be glad to come to the committee and talk to us about ways that that legislature needs to have bills to tweak things so that we can save money. But she can't do it because of different various things, so I want her to come and speak to us too. And then we can, as a committee, be ready when session starts next year with bills that we support as a committee. You know, and I think that we really need to think about doing something like that. So,
yeah.
Is there anything else?
Yeah. We're glad to help any way we can.
Okay.
We're playing with lots of little cost control things all the time. I'm starting to pull together an experimental procedures committee, because as you develop greater and greater technology and everybody's doing a little bit of this and that, we get into medicine that sometimes you don't know if it's an appropriate expenditure or not, and we're going to pull together an experimental treatment committee to start reviewing that and looking at increased quality control utilization review.
Those are big questions.
Yeah.
Yep.
Interview.
Yep. Quality control is something
anyway,
that's
thank
a new
you very much. I appreciate it very much. And if you think of anything, call my office and
I will do that.
Rattle it off to somebody.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, we adjourned.
All right.
You know what?
Getting ready for the next
I am,
one.
I'm not going to adjourn. I am going to recess at the call of the chair. Okay? And then that gives us any time we can do it.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.